Hi, I'm Vernon Trollinger for Optometry Times, and this is 10 questions for Rohit Sharma, OD, President of Southern Eye Specialists. Where did you grow up?
I grew up in Nairobi, Kenya, where at the age of 13, I came to the United States and grew up in San Diego. Then I did my undergrad in Northern California at Berkeley. Mm-hmm. Went to Boston to do my doctorate and graduated in 99, where I moved to Philadelphia to practice optometry right out of school and practiced there for 5 years all over Philadelphia and in Reading. And then in 2004, I came to Atlanta and have been practicing for the most part private optometry for the majority part of that.
You were in Reading, Pennsylvania?
I actually was, if you know where that is.
I grew up there.
You did?
Yes.
So I actually practice on Penn Street.
In downtown Reading, yeah.
Downtown Reading. I was there before they built the Wachovia Center where they had
one
of the big WWF and boxing matches. And I was there 2 years, from 99 to 2001.
Well, how about that? It is a
small world, huh?
Yeah. Okay, now, what was it about your initial VOSH experience that kept you involved with working in developing countries?
I've always known the need for eye care. And growing up in Kenya, you have a lot of people that actually are impoverished, who just have a hard time accessing healthcare, whether they're living in a remote part of the country or lack of accessibility due to the number of providers there. So I actually started participating in the VOSH and, at the grassroots level in terms of, gathering glasses and cleaning glasses, doing some prescription. And when I went to my first mission was in a very remote town called Chetumal in Mexico, in the southern part of the state of, I believe it's in Quintana Roo, which is about 30 minutes north of Belize. It was just a fantastic experience. We worked hard. We examined, I don't know, 1,000 eyes, maybe more. And just the gratification you get by seeing people just smile. And one of the things that I will always remember is I met a lady that she was 90 years old or something to that degree, and the glasses she had were beat up, they were broken, they were taped. I mean, you name it, she had it. And she had it like that for like 50 years. I mean, it was ridiculous. And it was kind of embarrassing that, how come she could not get another pair of glasses? This is an injustice to its core. We were able to find a pair of glasses and, switch the lenses. And just seeing somebody smile like that just gave me so much satisfaction. More than, economics to a certain degree. When you can help somebody and just achieve some degree of less difficulty than what they can normally do, it just sheds light on really at the end of the day what's really important. And that's just helping people, and by able to achieve her to see and able to get a pair of glasses, it just opened up my heart even that much more. So from then on I said, I want to dedicate myself to helping others. And from there it led me to a second mission where we were in Merida, which is 3.5-4 hours west, probably west of Cancun City. And that was, again, a fantastic time in a nice colonial city. But again, the same rules apply where the ultimate instant gratification you get. To a certain point, it humbles you. It's regretfully, I'm saying that you sometimes get greater gratification helping people in that part of the world or developing countries as opposed to what I do on a day-to-day basis, because what we do is expected of us to do. But when you go to other parts of the world, it's never expected, but it's actually appreciated. And just the difference puts everything in perspective. And then, from there, after graduating, I consulted with a couple non-government organizations around the world to just provide healthcare to impoverished people around the world. And I did some work in Kenya. I did some work in Guatemala, Costa Rica, and El Salvador. And it was just fantastic. And again, the same rules apply. Instant gratification, seeing people smile, and just the ability to just help them see from a refractive error. So when you start examining people's eyes and you realize, you know, this is a pandemic. It's not just a, you know, a Mexico problem or a Guatemalan problem. It's a worldwide problem. And you start saying, you know, things need to be done. And it's a good thing that we're beginning to see many different projects coming around the world where we can help people function better. And just purely by providing eye care, and, you know, back in the day, before Skojo, you're probably familiar with Skojo, but before Skojo ever became this big, I actually met them in El Salvador. We were working on a project at the same place. They were doing some other, you know, microeconomics project, which they also do in India. And it's a great, you know, great idea. You're providing a lifestyle for people, but you're also helping people, and you're creating small business models where it can be sustainable and people can, you know, make a decent living off that by providing care. And that to me was just fantastic. So, you know, that's in a nutshell how I got involved with Vosh. And then, you know, when you get married and you get kids, and then things change a little bit.
See, after working for 4 years in Philadelphia and in Southeast Pennsylvania, why did you return to Kenya in 2002?
In 2002, I was working in writing. I kind of got a little bit burnt out with working in commercial optometry, and I was given the opportunity to do some type of, you know, work with missionaries and also non-government organizations providing health care. My dad is actually involved, at the time was involved in running eye clinics in three different countries, and you know, he needed some help, so I said, you know what, I'll come down and help you out. And I worked 6 weeks in Tanzania, a couple weeks in Kenya, in the capital in Tanzania, in a city called Dar es Salaam, which is run by government, local government, as well as a non-government organization out of Germany called Christopher Blind Mission. Most people who've heard of these type of ophthalmology NGOs has heard, because they're the world's largest. And I mean, it was fantastic. I was examining 350 patients a day, providing refractive prescriptions, and, you know, things that you see, you can never see in the United States. And you just have a real appreciation for what we have and the simplicity of life. And, you know, these people, patients not complaining, they'll sit in a room for 8 hours before they see the doctor, and they'll never give you any hassle. And it puts everything in perspective. Saying, you know, this is the way life should be. But, you know, from a personal point of view, whatever I contributed, I think I got 10 times back out of it. But you know, that's how I ended up in East Africa, is to provide some professional optometry work, and just also to increase some degree of efficiency in the optical, because we're not doing certain things correctly. So they're trying to see how they can generate more revenue and see more patients. So I was a little bit instrumental in assisting the project over there.
So in what ways does training for an NGO delivering eye care differ from, you know, an everyday private practice?
You know, and that's an interesting question. The main difference is over there, they have what are called medical assistants in layman's terms. They call it something else there, and hopefully it comes to my mind. But the differences over there is, because there's lack of qualified people, or number of optometrists, qualified number of optometrists or ophthalmologists, and a lot of those are actually centered in the city, just like everywhere else. They're always in the main city centers. So because of that, when you're in the remote areas, they have to train a lot of people to do certain procedures. So what I was involved in just doing the refractive part. So they had stations, so we would refract somebody and see if we can get them down to, you know, 20, 30, 20, 40. If they were good, we'd write them a prescription and we would hand them off and they would go to the optical. But if for any particular reason they could not get better than that, we would send them to the next stop, which would be behind the slit lamp, which would involve a medical assistant. And if they could not generate the problem, then it went one step further to an ophthalmologist. I didn't notice the vision was in 2050, 2060, and I could see a cataract through my retinoscopy. I would send them to the second station. If they noticed the patient has glaucoma, they would be then sent to the cataract doctor, who would then also manage the cataract and the glaucoma. prior to surgery. And in those parts of the world, they don't have subspecialists. It's just general ophthalmologists, and they pretty much do everything. And a lot of times they were German-trained or American-trained, some English-trained. And the gentleman I was working with was, he was Kenyan. He's Caucasian, and he was actually a general ophthalmologist. His father was actually the first flying surgeon of Kenya and was knighted by the Queen, and he is Caucasian. But no one would ever imagine that fourth generation or third generation Kenyan Caucasian living in Kenya. You know, so he actually was working for Christopher Bland Mission, and I worked with him, worked with a German ophthalmologist also, and it was fantastic. It shows us that care can be delivered. It just doesn't make it right or wrong. It doesn't make us better. It just, you know, breaks things down to its most simple element, which is, you know, figuring out what the problem is and passing it on to somebody who knows the next step, what to do. But it was interesting they had the medical assistants that were trained, you know, going through, you know, a 2-year course of how to diagnose cataracts. Some of them would be doing chalazion on removals. Some would, you know, understand what glaucoma is. And believe it or not, some of them would actually do cataract surgery because it's such a demand, and one cataract surgeon cannot do all of them. So they had to offset and train people how to do it. And, you know, some cataracts were successful, some were not. But it was interesting to see how they dealt with the problem by creating a solution that somewhat worked.
How many patients were you seeing in that kind of setting? Or like in a day?
We were seeing, I think it was three refractionists. Actually, I was the optometrist. We had an optician from India that was trained, was excellent. And then they had one local that was trained in Tanzania. So we had three. And then we would probably say about between 350, 400 patients a day. So you can imagine there was, you know, 5-minute lunches and 30-second breaks in the bathroom.
Hold this, I'll be back, yeah.
Exactly.
What's something your colleagues don't know about you?
That I'm very passionate about what I do. I think it's easy for people to say, yay, you know, he likes what I do. But I really love optometry. I think optometry, I was born for optometry. I think the medical aspect of that is just fantastic. It keeps it exciting. But one thing that people don't know about me is I love the business aspect. I love the challenge of how to be more productive and a better optometrist and businessman than the day before. That's one thing. The other thing, and most of the people that, you know, my colleagues that don't know about me, is I actually love to dance, and I love Latin music.
Ah,
uh-huh. Yes. So that's what I used to do in Reading in my spare time. Is I used to dance in the exam room between patients, learning my routine. So when I go out to ask the girl out, at least I'd know something. But you don't have to put this on the podcast.
What's your favorite Latin dance?
Salsa. So salsa is my favorite. Yeah. You know, one thing I just came to mind. One thing that most colleagues don't know about me is I love hiking. And one of the things on my bucket list that I was able to accomplish back in February 18, 2014, is I actually summited Mount Kilimanjaro.
Oh.
So that is what most 99% of my colleagues do not know about me. I've actually summited Kilimanjaro. And on one of the worst nights ever, where we actually experienced a blizzard, and we had to walk through a blizzard.
And you got to the top. Through the blizzard, during the blizzard, or after?
While we started hiking at about 16,500 feet, it started snowing. And eventually we got a blizzard. And up there at almost, you know, 18,000-19,000 feet, the snow comes down pretty fast.
Uh-huh.
And we, you know, you couldn't see 100 yards in front of you. Actually, maybe even 50 yards was maybe the tops that you could see. And I have pictures that I show people all the time that ask me. In fact, a patient asked me today to show it to her husband. and he did not believe it's actually the highest point in Africa. I said, he said, this looks like Colorado. I said, you're absolutely right. It does look like Colorado. But most pictures that people see, they see a yoga pose, they see, you know, it's clear skies, but not the day I did. I guess it had to make me special that night, because it was the most unusual, most atypical summit photo that anyone has ever seen. So that is one thing that I said most colleagues do not know about me is I love hiking.
So with all your international charitable and consulting work and climbing Mount Kilimanjaro, why do you still come back to having a private practice?
Well, one thing is my family is here in Atlanta. I purchased one of the oldest offices in the city of Atlanta. This year is celebrating 59 years. For me to travel around with family, it's very difficult. I'm successfully married for going on 14 years. You know, you lose track after 10. Two girls. But we still have our eye of traveling. So we still travel to distant parts of the world. In a couple of weeks, we're going to Thailand. Going to do some work there with the company. But I just love business in general, and I love striving to make a profitable business by providing the best healthcare. So my goal, my mission statement in my office is literally to provide the best eye care in the city of Atlanta in the best atmosphere possible. And that's what I strive every day is to be better than I was the day before.
Well, that leads me to my next question, conveniently enough. What are the hallmarks of excellent customer service?
My answer to that hallmark is a smile. We forget to smile in today's world. We forget to say thank you. We forget to say please. I think in today's world, we've lost a little bit of humbleness and maybe a little bit of Southern hospitality that the South still has. So one of the things that I instill in my practice with all my patients is we always come out and greet our patients. We greet them with a smile. We say hello as if it's a family atmosphere. We treat all our patients as if they were a family. We love them like family. We'll address them if they did something wrong like family. But we always try to be transparent, and we try to provide them the best in technology, in innovation, in products, in science. And we do that all with a smile. And I think when we realize that patients' experience is all that is important. We can do a semi-decent exam, not that we should, but if we treat them like gold, they will remember you forever. And we have patients keep coming to us year after year. And you know, our practice is now celebrating 59 years, and I'm the third optometrist to take over. So in 59 years, there've only been three people or three optometrists, and we hardly ever advertise. We always believe in word of mouth, but we believe how you institute that is by providing excellent service and always asking your patients, if you're not happy with the service, what can we do better? And that we actually have a clipboard at the front when patients check out, and I tell my patients, if there's anything that you feel that we have lacked in your service, please write it down, because my goal is to provide you better service the next time than you experience this time. And if there's anything you have in mind, please write it down and place it in the box that we have, and we'll make sure we review it, and we're going to try to make sure we can instill it. So I think these are all sort of small nuggets that literally are hallmark of good customer service. Because, you know, good customer service to me may be something totally different than the person down the street. You know, we look at our patients as patients. We don't look at our patients as numbers. And in today's world, unfortunately, with healthcare, the direction it's going, they're bottling and boxing most patients as people, but and numbers, but not as actual human bodies. It's like herding cattle. And unfortunately, that's just the time frame that we're in.
What do you look for when it comes to staff?
First and foremost, what I look for is personality. You can buy personality. You can train them to do what you want. So to me, it's personality is important. Number two is work ethic. I think work ethic is extremely important because, again, you cannot train somebody to have a work ethic. if they have bad work ethic, unfortunately, that's them. And I think that also comes with personality. So work ethic, personality is what I look for. Unfortunately, I don't know why, but in medicine, you predominantly have women than men. And maybe in optometry, because a certain part of it has to be retail. I always have women that apply for positions. In fact, all my staff are women. And they're fantastic. They're, you know, upbeat personalities. Again, you can't train for that. But also you want to train for a certain degree of skill, you know, how fast do they pick things up? Are they good with time management? Are they eager to learn? When I look for staff, they really have to want to be there. If they don't want to come to office and, you know, you see them, struggling in, they've had a bad day, or, you know, they're just there as a human body just to get a paycheck. I think that's actually doing an injustice to the business and an injustice to the patient, because that always resurrects to the patient and says, you know what, this is not the kind of people that should be representing your company. So I try to stray away from, you know, those type of personalities, because that's what you're going to see in an interview.
What would you change if you could do your life over?
That's a difficult question. I don't think I would change anything, because I'm a very optimistic person. I think we're brought into this world for a particular reason. And yeah, we could say, if I had to change my life over, I'd love to be 007. I think that's the role of a lifetime. But I think my previous experiences have made me the person I am today. You know, the personal struggles that one person goes, it just makes them that much stronger. The relationships they build make them that much stronger. It has nothing to do with economics. Economics is shown not to be, you know, the top three, four things that make people happy. I think if, you know, there's certain things I would do a little different. You know, you'd pay a little bit more attention to certain things as you're growing up that your parents told you. Maybe work harder, you know, save your money, use it for things that are worthwhile and not to waste it away. And, you know, these are all hindsight's 20/20. Parents have told us this many times, and we never listened. And now we're shooting ourselves, saying we should have listened. But again, that's all part of learning. It's part of growing. You got to fall 10 times before you realize, you know what, maybe I should trip over that rock every single time. I should really watch where I'm walking, you know. But for the most part, I'm very happy with my life. It has blessed me by the grace of the Almighty. I don't think I could. I never anticipated me having the type of happiness in my career and the lifestyle that I have now. And I think it's all about, you know, the lessons we've learned in life is just working hard and really strive to be a better person and do what you love. If you don't do what you love, you're doing an injustice to your own life. So I'm very grateful for what I have, and I wouldn't change a thing. Going back to your question that you asked, I have no regrets. For the most part, optometry has treated me well. My personal life has been in the ups and downs like us all, but I think these are all lessons that have deliberately been placed on me to make me the person that I am today.
Okay, well, you've traveled extensively. So what's your guilty pleasure food?
My guilty pleasures, I would say, you know, it depends. Are we talking food, or are we talking liquid diet? You know, because I have a couple, you know. My guilty pleasure is I love a good glass of scotch. And, you know, whiskey for me is one of God's greatest creations. I love scotch. I love Indian food, and me being Indian, I think it's my call. It's so flavorful. It's got a lot of spice to it. It brings all the essence of life in somebody. I love Thai food. Food is one of my, you know, anything Thai that I love. Thai food is, again, one of the best cuisines for me. But, you know, those three things I would say are my guilty pleasures. And, you know, sometimes, you know, I do love cheesecake, you know, But I'm more of a savory guy than a sweet guy.
What's one thing that you'd change about optometry as it is now?
One thing that I would change with optometry that is now is the heavy involvement of commercialization of optometry. I would say that I've never known optometry any other way but the heavy involvement of commercialization. The stories that I've heard when, you know, in private practice, the insurance companies were not dictating the medical side of it, but unfortunately, you know, with the advent of, you know, the box chains, not to name names particularly, but, you know, the box change, you know, the buy two glasses, the free eye exam, I think that has really devalued the profession and has cheapened it to a point that a lot of people don't have any value for what actually a visit to see a doctor means. Because you can go see the doctor for free if you buy two pairs of glasses. And most of the patients, when they see that and now you're charging a, you know, X dollar amount for a particular exam, they can't justify the value. They think it's the same, and unfortunately it's not. And we're one of the few, probably one of the fewest professions that have actually cheapened and devalued the business side of medicine. You know, we've never experienced this in dentistry. We're beginning to see it. You've never seen it in primary care. No one says, yeah, go see that doctor because, you know, it's free. You know, as long as you get a prescription, you buy a bottle of cream for them, it's free. And it's unfortunate that it has become that way. And why, I'm not sure. But that's one of the things that I would say that I regret I would change in optometry is the commercialization of our industry. You know, and then when I say commercialization, I'm also talking about online, even though we have about 4 to 5% of patients or consumers purchase eyewear online, it's not the same as physically going into the eye doctor and having somebody who is skilled know what they're talking about and can fit you with a pair of glasses that actually fits you correctly. If I had a dollar for every patient I see that has purchased a pair of glasses that absolutely does not fit them correctly, we would not be having this conversation because I would be on an island somewhere by now. And it's unfortunate because everybody is quick to make a sale, but nobody is sitting back saying, you know what, this is a patient that's spending their hard-earned money. Let's fit them with the best product available, not the best product they have in the store. And unfortunately, they sell them a product with what they have in store because they're not thinking outside the box. And you know what? Let me order something for you. It's a special order. I think it's going to fit you much better if that's okay with you. I think that's how you gain loyalty. That's how you differentiate yourself. And in today's world, everyone's just quick to make a quick sale and to forget about the patient. And, you know, when you have this online business, it's the same concept where people are just buying things. And, again, it's devalued that skill when you go into a doctor's office and you're getting fitted. Patients are saying, hey, I can do that myself. But they don't realize they don't have that skill. They don't have the knowledge. And unfortunately, again, I blame our profession because our profession has, you know, taken that direction through commercialization, cheapening the value of seeing a doctor, cheapening the value of not having trained people examine you. You know, you go to online retailers, you know, box stores. Again, they're paid heavily on commission to, you know, spit out a sale. These are not skilled people. These are just people who are just taught to sell, but not taught to treat patients. And unfortunately, it's a problem in my book. Other of my associates may say, hey, you know, it's not a problem to them. But, you know, we're a specialty store. We're, you know, we practice in, you know, middle to low middle income America. We have our patients mean the world to us. And, you know, we try to make our representation of how medicine should be. And the direction we're trying to make and trying to make an impact on society, that this is the way things should be done. And that's why you come see Dr. Sharma and his staff at Southern Eye Specialists, because you will be treated correctly. You will be fitted with the right pair of glasses. You're not going to be sold something because the staff is getting a commission, because I don't believe in commission. I give people, I pay my staff well. That's one of the other questions you had asked me earlier, is pay your staffs well, you'll get lemonade out of them. But treat them well, treat them like family, and, you know, the sky's the horizon. But when you start bombarding people with, you know, commission, you don't incentivize them the right way, we start seeing a devalue of the profession in general, and the traits that have made it so incredibly important, we cheapen it, and it's unfortunate. I don't like that, but that's what I would change in the profession from that aspect.
Last question. We inflict this one on everybody. What's the craziest thing you've ever done?
The craziest thing I've ever done. You know what? My wife tells me I'm straight as an arrow. She's like, I've never met somebody as boxy as you. The craziest thing I've ever done. Does this go on the podcast?
See what you're comfortable with. Go ahead.
Okay. So one of the things I would say that, to a certain degree, I'm a little bit embarrassed about is, like I told you, I love dancing. And me and my close friends at optometry school, we used to go to the clubs in Boston, the great city, to go have fun. So for 4 years, we were, like, known in all the clubs in Boston. So we would just walk right in. And I would dance from 10 p.m. to, like, 2 in the morning. And we would hardly ever take a break. And I would be so drenched. You know, I would be dancing in my undershirt, you know, and the sleeveless undershirt, the tank top type undershirts.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, I would be dancing in that, and, you know, and I used to work out at that time, so, you know, maybe there was a little bit of insecurity. I wanted the ladies to see me. Uh-huh. But needless to say, that's one of the embarrassing things and the craziest thing that I have done is that. So that's number one. The second craziest thing I've ever done, I actually did that with my wife. When we went to Thailand on our honeymoon back in 2004, we just landed in the airport in Thailand, in the island of Phuket. And we met this other couple, and this other couple said, hey, you know, are you going to the full moon party? And we said, no. He's like, why don't you come with us? You'll have a great time. Not knowing what we were agreeing on, we said, sure, it sounds like a party. Why not? So he said, okay, meet us at the lobby at around 10:45 p.m. And that's, I'm like, okay, great. So I'm dressed like I'm going to a club. We go, he's like, okay, I think you're a little overdressed, but you should be fine. We take the taxi to the dock. We get onto a speedboat, and we're going, what, 50, 60 miles on a speedboat into the oblivion, into darkness. And I'm thinking, I think I'm just going, this guy's going to kill me. He's going to, like, cut me up and throw me to the sharks. So I'm like, where are we going? He's like, we're going to an island called Koh Phangan, which is, it's about an hour speedboat into oblivion off Phuket. And almost 45 minutes later, we get to this island, and it's a rave party where you have people, you know, doing, you know, these fireballs that they're twisting around. There's electronica music everywhere, and it goes on to, like, 4 in the morning. And then the speedboats all come back, and you have to jump onto the speedboat to take you back home, you know, and you're standing in the ocean with, like, 300 people, half of them drunk, and you're wondering, what's going on in the water right about now, you know? Which is disgusting to think of, but that is the craziest thing that I've done. And my wife looks at me and says, I'm so going to shoot you, you know, for agreeing to come here. But we look back and we had a great time, you know? Mm-hmm. But it's called a full moon party, and if anybody ever goes to Thailand, to this island called Koh Phangan, they know about it. And to tell you how small this world is, there's a company that runs my website, Every month we have a conference call with him. We were talking. He's like, "Oh, so aren't you going to a trip sometime soon?" I said, "Yeah, I'm going to Thailand." He said, "You must go to Koh Phangan." I said, "I've been there." He started laughing. He's like, "Full moon party?" I said, "Yes, sir." You know, it's a small world, but needless to say, you know, standing in ocean water that happens to be a little bit warm at 4 in the morning with a bunch of drunk people, it's not the best place to be at that point, you know. So outside of that, and dancing in my tank top in Boston is one of the craziest things I've did. You know, my wife thinks, you know, climbing Mount Kilimanjaro was crazy to begin with. I think it's not that bad, but needless to say, I'm pretty much a straight shooter. My wife says the straightest person she's ever known.
Well, Raheem, it was great talking with you today. Thanks for taking.